Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, the show where each week we speak to pharma company owners and industry leaders sharing their stories of personal and professional growth. We're now on series four of the show, and as you may already be aware, we're on a mission to help clinical researchers from around the world with tips, tricks, and inspiration. So if you could do me a quick favor and please hit that follow or subscribe button, it really does help more than you'll ever know. Once again, Adam Walker is alongside me, so sit back, relax, and we'll take things from here. This week, Adam and I are joined by Melissa Church, Senior Vice President of Strategy and Solutions at Catalyst Clinical Research over in North Carolina. Adam, Melissa, welcome to the show. How are you folks doing?
Oh, thanks so much. Doing well and looking forward to talking about Catalyst and my favorite subject, which is myself.
You're in the right place.
Well, look, Melissa, I guess Senior Vice President of Strategy and Solutions at Catalyst. Look, in your own words, give us a bit of an overview of what a Senior Vice President of Strategy and Solutions does and what Catalyst is all about, I guess.
Sure. So I'm going to start with Catalyst because that'll make it a little easier to describe what I do. Catalyst is a small, large CRO or a mid-sized, small CRO. We kind of play with the definitions a little bit. We're about 400 full-time staff, and then we have about another 400 contractors, consultants that we work with. And we have two lines of business that we go to market with. One is Catalyst Oncology, which is our full service oncology CRO focused on small to mid-size emerging biotechs. Mm-hmm. These companies are coming to market with some really innovative science, and we love working in that space, and particularly in the early phase trials, phase one, phase one, two. And then our other line of business is Catalyst Flex. So Catalyst Flex is our multi-therapeutic resourcing and functional business where we can kind of meet the client where they are, whether it's another CRO or a large pharma company or some of those small and emerging biotech companies. We can listen to what their needs are and then come to them with either a resourcing solution, so giving them some bodies to do the work, or a functional solution where we manage the resources for specific functions and then deliver the services that they need.
I like it. So kind of in a nutshell, it's you're small enough to keep it personal, but large enough to offer a bit more flexibility depending on the solution that clients need effectively.
Yes, that's exactly where we're trying to sit. And while we do want to grow and we have a very well thought out growth plan that we're working towards, we don't ever want to be PPD or IQVIA, mentioning our competitors. We just don't want to be that big. We want to be able to continue to have that personal touch with our clients. That's really important to us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And look, I guess that we'll kick off and where I often like to, and that is how you first got into this industry, because I know that it was a little bit, I guess, probably like a lot of folks, not necessarily planned, but if you can share how you got into the industry and a bit about your background.
Sure. So definitely no plan at all. I started out my career actually as an administrative assistant in an environmental engineering firm. So nowhere even near clinical research or even the health industry as a whole. But I happened to be at the time the only person in the office who knew how to use Microsoft Word. And that was at the point that the US government was switching from Word Perfect, which some people out there may be old enough to remember Word Perfect as the word processing software, right? And moving into Microsoft Word for how they wanted proposals submitted. So they'd issue an RFP, my company would submit a response. We had been doing it in Word Perfect, they now required it in Microsoft Word. And suddenly I was a proposal analyst because I knew how to use Microsoft Word.
Wow.
And that really kicked off my career. And my very next job was with a CRO called Clin Trials, which doesn't exist anymore. They got acquired, I believe, by Kendall way back in the day. and moving in as working in proposals as a proposal analyst for clin trials. And that really kicked off kind of my career journey. So everything that I have done has been tied to sales operations, strategy, and that's allowed me to really, when you think about, let me take a step back. When you think about proposals, I like to say, if you work in a proposal organization in any industry, you learn about the entire business. You also learn about where all the dead bodies are, which is an interesting, interesting bit of kind of benefit to working in those roles, because you really get to dive into everything that's going on in the organization because you're trying to respond to clients' requests. Well, that gives you a really good base to grow your career and to move up into progressive leadership roles in a variety of areas of business. So it's been a wild ride. I've been in the CRO industry a few different times before Catalyst. I was actually with United Health Group, which for those listeners in the US, they'll know that's one of the largest insurance providers in the country, and also one of the largest providers through their Optum brand of health-related services and technologies. So I spent 9 years with them, but just before that, I was with PPD, and that's how I got to know a lot of my Catalyst colleagues.
Right.
And after 9 years at United, it was time for a change, and I had been in contact with some of my PPD friends that had gone to work with Catalyst, and they asked me, hey, you want to come work with us? And I thought, well, sure, why not?
I like it. And look, just on that proposal front, I guess kind of my background is in engineering and construction recruitment. So I was dealing a lot, sometimes it with, you know, there'd be an environmental proposal, sometimes it'd be more the engineering consultancy just doing the construction work. And it's quite similar, isn't it, how the, I guess this, how it's structured of projects to CRO world, I guess. So that's interesting there. And I guess what was then the draw to Catalyst? So your PPD friend said, hey, you know, do you want to come over? I know that that's how often I've made career jumps in the past, because you go with the people that you like. And, you know, we spend such a massive amount of time at work, so it's got to be, you know, working with people that we can get on with. What was the draw? What was the I guess kind of the USP really that they were talking about that led you to say, hey, you know what, I'm going to come on board, and that sounds great, etc.
I think about it from the perspective of when you reach a certain point in your career, different things are important, right? So at a senior level, I had been in a executive level role at United, and the things that were really important to me were the company culture. One of the things I really loved about United, even though it's never easy to work for a company that's that large because of all the red tape, was that we had an incredibly strong, healthy corporate culture and a commitment at the highest levels in the organization to keep that culture alive, to keep bringing people into workshops and teaching them about the culture and building leaders that really led from a place where the culture, where they started with the culture. And so as I got to know Nick Dyer, who's our CEO, and got to spend some more time with my friends talking about what they were doing at Catalyst, I was so impressed that a company that was that small and kind of that nascent in its journey was putting a tremendous amount of focus on building a healthy company culture. That's not something you typically see in a startup. You know, they're just, startups are typically so busy just getting started up and getting the job done and building out new business. They don't always think about the kind of culture they're building around them. And if you, one of the things that I frequently say about culture is if you're not focused on building a positive company culture, the culture is going to build up around you, whether you want it to or not. And it may or may not look like what you ideally want it to look like if you're not paying attention to it.
Most so that was definitely.
Yeah. So that was really the first win for me as I got to know Catalyst better and started considering working with them. The other win was I was going to get to do things that I had kind of touched in the past, but I hadn't been able to really dive into them. So when I thought about, or we started talking about my job responsibilities, being responsible for developing a 5-year strategic plan for the business. I'd led plan development, I'd contributed to plan development at lots of different companies, but I'd never really been the one true owner of developing the plan and getting it approved. So that was a big deal for me. Mm. It made me super uncomfortable, to be fair. Like, I spent probably a good 8 months having daily panic attacks as I was developing this plan, because then I knew, like, I had to get it done. I had to get it approved by the CEO. I had to get it approved by our investors. I had to get it approved by the board. So it was a big deal to take something from idea stage and working with all my peers in the organization and moving it through to approval. So knowing that I was going to step into a role where I really got to own that type of activity was incredibly positive for me. Mm. And then the last thing was, I just missed the CRO business. It had always been throughout my career. And I did it multiple times throughout my career, worked in those businesses. I really love it. Like, it is such a fun business to be in. It's so exciting. You get to see that nascent treatments coming through clinical trials, and then hopefully watch them be successful, have great results, and then eventually come to market. It's just really meaningful, impactful work.
Amazing. And look, I'm not sure if you're aware, Adam, but I've seen quite a bit of Nick on LinkedIn. He was actually a guest on Jeff Harmon's podcast not so long back. And if you've not checked him out, it is well worth checking Jeff's podcast with him on it, because just talking to the culture, it's almost unbelievable to see that sort of thing from what I class as a fairly sizable organization now, you know, 400 staff. I don't class that as small, you know. For us at Huxley Morton, we're a team of 10. It's, you know, that is quite a large organization. So to have those values that he seems to be putting in place is quite, yeah, just quite impressive, really. Adam, you want to add something there? Go on.
I don't know Nick, but obviously, yeah, we've interviewed Jeff, and I've spoken to him on a number of occasions, and I know he works with a lot of very, very aware leaders. That's the point, isn't it? You know, he works with people and brings out the best in them. I think, Melissa, what, you know, to James's point, the size of the organization, it doesn't sound and feel like a startup. You know, those kind of numbers, 400 permanents, 400 flexible staff, that's significant. And I'm sure your turnover would speak to that point. But also with, you know, a similar background to yours in, I also worked within United Health Group when they when they had an arm called
I-3. I did not know that, Adam. Yeah. I did not know that.
I-3, which is now Syneos Health, I worked for many years ago, and I'd never heard of United Health until I was under their umbrella as well. They're enormous. I mean, they're literally like, I don't know, between 80 and 100,000 employees worldwide, aren't they? Something like that when I was working for them.
It's well over 100,000 now.
Okay.
Well,
I'm showing my age, but that was about maybe 10 plus years ago. And actually, I felt I was a very, very small fish in a very big pond there. I mean, it was an amazing organization, but I felt lost, if I'm honest. It was too big for me. And I think what's interesting that you're describing is really the, you know, the experience of getting under the skin of a company and really defining your culture, your processes, and the principles to which you want your staff to work to on the door.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think you and I may have been at United at the same time, because it was about 11 years ago when I started there. So,
quite possibly. There might have been some overlap, yes.
Yes, maybe offline we can talk more about United.
So when you were, because you were at United, as you say, for kind of 9 years, Melissa, and you got to a very senior level there. So, you know, what was the difference? I mean, how did you feel going from such a huge organization to somewhere that wasn't so small? And what were the pros and cons for that you experienced? Just in case there's, you know, our listeners that are thinking of doing the same, or, you know, looking at career changes where, because you must have, to an extent, perhaps been in a bit of a comfort zone there if you'd built up and, you know, got your team and it was all going well, et cetera.
Yeah, well, and United's kind of a well, I won't say a different animal. I've worked for a lot of large companies, but United's the largest I'd ever worked for. And what I would say about being at United and the difference between being at United and Catalyst is at United, I always felt like I was pushing sand uphill. So when trying to get things done, you know, it was just a continual, who else do I need to influence? Who else do I need to reach out and touch? Who else do I need to kind of check the box, whether they have a vote or not, to ensure I can move things forward? It was never easy. It was never a straight path. It was never even really a clear path. So I had a great career at United. If you've been around United, and Adam, you may have heard this. If you don't like your job at United, wait 6 months, it'll change. My job changed every 6 months. I never had time to get bored. I never really had time to get super comfortable because things were always evolving. Things were always changing. I would be given responsibilities for a variety of teams. And then 6 months later, I'd be asked to lay off two or three of those teams. So it was, you know, it was just chaos all the time. So switching to making the move, I knew I wanted to leave United. I knew I was kind of tired of the big corporate, my job changing every 6 months, like it being so hard to get things done. So I was already targeting, as I was thinking about changing jobs, I was already targeting smaller companies and wanting to be somewhere where I really had direct access to all of the executive team so that I could get things done.
Mm-hmm.
I never imagined that I would land in a role working directly for a CEO, although that's another story for another day, but when you work for the CEO, you get things done. Like it just happens, right? Because you have the ability to both influence up and across,
mm-hmm.
and very closely, because you know you're sitting right there, metaphorically sitting right there next to them. And that made the Catalyst job, again, made it very appealing. And just the more family feel of a smaller company, you can really get to, even with 400 people in the company full time, I haven't talked to everybody, but I've talked to a lot of people, like more probably than I ever did in my 9 years at United. I know more people in more functions at Catalyst than I ever did in 9 years at United, because we are small enough that when I do a presentation about something or I'm on the town hall, I get to see almost everybody. And that's just a different feeling. And I love it so much. I love that smaller, closer feel.
I like that. And I think that as you said at the beginning of the show, you know, everyone to an extent likes talking about themselves. They like the sound of their own name. And I think if you're in an organization where you know, almost everyone by their first name, it just feels better. Yeah. So look, that was fairly early on in 2020, where there were some big things that happened around the world, right?
Yes.
Was it April 2020 you joined Catalyst?
I did.
What did things look like at that time? Because for many businesses, it was chaos, regardless of big, small, one-man band, consultant, you know, everyone was kind of thinking, what's going on? And that's almost how this podcast came about, was because people were asking me as a recruiter, what's going on at this company? What's this leader doing? So how did that look in the early days for yourself?
Yeah, so who changes jobs in the middle of a pandemic, right? And really at the very beginning of a pandemic, I always do things the hard way. So I decided that was a good time to change jobs. But coming into Catalyst, you know, yeah, it wasn't as chaotic as I expect it was in other companies, because another one of the great things about Catalyst is we have a really strong investment partner. And our investment partner brought to us, as part of them buying into the company, to the organization, a management system that is really built towards identifying red flags very early. And then there are processes built into it to allow us to dive in when we see those red flags, figure out the root cause, and then action plan around that root cause.
Could you give us an example? Sorry to jump in. What would, I guess, classify as a red flag, if you've got any scenarios? Because I guess it's there, yeah, someone in charge of strategy and solutions, I'm guessing a lot of these things would land on your desk, right?
Not as much as you would think, thankfully. While I have responsibility for marketing, communications, business development, and then corporate strategy and M&A. That's all fantastic. But if I'm thinking about what was happening during the early part of COVID, one of the biggest challenges we had was in our resource business, our resourcing business, because we place a lot of CRAs on clinical trials for other sponsors, other companies. Mm. And when COVID hit and all the sites shut down, suddenly nobody needs CRAs because nobody's letting CRAs on, you know, on site. Mm. And then only, you know, a certain number of trials were really set up for remote monitoring at that point. So when I think about the management system, when I came in and I sat in, we review it monthly. When I sat in the first review, one of the things that very quickly jumped out to me was we immediately saw that business drop off from the resourcing business. And we were able to immediately start planning around, okay, how do we know this business probably isn't going to come back quickly. Because at that point, we all kind of, you know, we were starting to see this is not going to be
alarm bells kind of, yeah.
Right. This is not going to be a month or two. This is going to be a very long time period. So we were able to start action planning around, okay, if that business is going to drop off, what can we do to accelerate in some of our other areas of business so we can close that revenue gap? And without a doubt, I got to see some of the most collaborative, problem-solving, positive conversations I've ever seen in a business. Now, again, I was new to this process, so I was stepping in completely unaware of how everything would work. But the level of constructive or healthy conflict that I've observed, and now that I've been a part of, as I've been doing this for over 2 years now, was so impressive. And the fact that that leadership team could see the problems, acknowledge the problems, dive in and figure out the root causes, and then start working to fix them was so impressive. Wow. I mean, no finger pointing, no, well, you should have done this, you should have done that. It was all about how do we fix this?
I'm just curious, Melissa, as you're describing that, thinking about, I mean, I think the three of us have one thing in common, and that's that we were all probably wondering how COVID would affect us all and pivoted accordingly. But as you were describing that, I was just wondering how a business pivots when effectively, you know, what you knew to be the standard was no longer. I mean, was there a furlough system in place in the US at that time? Were you able to put people on furlough and then be paid by the government to take a break? Because that was certainly something that happened in the UK. And I think for a lot of people, that was a lifesaver. I was never eligible for it myself, which was devastating as an independent consultant. But I know many people that did benefit from that. I'm just curious if that kind of helped and facilitated those conversations.
We did have, yes and no is probably the best way to answer that, because the resources that we place with clients are independent consultants. So if they were not, we were not able to place them, many of them work for multiple organizations. So they do 25% for us, they do 30% for another company, they do 30% for another company. So while we saw our work drop off, they likely were seeing that drop off in other places too, but they were eligible, I believe, do not quote me on this, I believe they were eligible to access some of the government funds that were available. Because they weren't our full-time employees, we just worked hard to place as many people as we could with the work that we still had going. We did have the advantage of, as we started, right before I joined the organization was when we got our very first full-service oncology win. And then that, our oncology business has just exploded, and it grew very quickly over 2020, even with COVID. And we service our own projects with contract CRAs. So we were able to place some of our contract CRAs on our own oncology projects. So that helped us bridge the gap internally from a revenue perspective, and also with some of our consultants externally.
Wow. I just remember that time. It's almost taken me back. It seems like a distant memory now, but everyone in the UK was just not knowing what to do. There was all sorts of systems in place. Unfortunately, like Adam, I didn't qualify either. I guess being, a business
makes you work
owner.
Harder though, doesn't it, James? I mean, that's what we both did. We worked,
indeed.
We worked and pedaled harder.
Yeah.
More than we'd ever done before, hence why we're even having this conversation today. You know, the podcast was born out of a crisis, wasn't it?
So how?
Well, yes, I was just going to say, crisis can lead to innovation for sure.
Definitely. And I was just going to say, I mean, you mentioned probably 5-6 minutes back about that you always tend to do things the hard way. and clearly it seems that you've perhaps had to, you know, to navigate through that system or that time with the management systems in place. But where does this, I guess, I don't know whether it's an urge or habit or just a coincidence that you end up doing things the hard way. Where does that come from? Is there, you know, any particular individuals, whether it's been, I don't know, your school life, your parents, or any mentors along the way that you've looked up to that have kind of ingrained that habit into you? Because I think that I've always been big on habits, routine, systems. So to hear that about the systems is great. But where do your personal kind of values and habits come from?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. The hard way thing is kind of a running joke between me and my friends and my work friends that know me well, just because I get bored really easily. So if I'm getting bored, I tend to make changes, and that can mean ask my husband. We move every 3 years. He's so done at this point. Like, please stop. We're not moving anymore. I'm like, okay, yeah, okay. And I, you know, like I said, at United, my job changed every 6 months. Some people, that's really tough, right? When your role continues to evolve, it's hard to get settled. It's hard to get in a routine. For me, I found it energizing most of the time. Like that was for me. That's why I was there for 9 years. I'd never had a minute to get bored, honestly. So, you know, when I think about mentors and kind of how I've grown my career, it probably starts with my mother and father, who were both very hard workers. And my mother was very entrepreneurial. I did not get that gene.
What did they both do, if you don't mind sharing?
So my father was a school teacher and then an administrator, but he was the relationship guy. Mm-hmm. So I learned all my relationship and really my beginnings of my leadership skills from him. My mother was just, I get a lot of my, if I get bored, it's, you know, from her, because she had a multitude of careers over her life. She went from working in farm lending, so doing loans for farmers in the area I grew up, to she decided she wanted to go into the restaurant business. So she bought a restaurant and ran it for many years, and then went into accounting. And that's kind of how she finished out her career, was with several different companies doing accounting work.
Wow, that's incredible. It's you know, it's similar to my parents. My dad worked in colleges and schools, not as a teacher. He was more on the administrative side, and he was always very quite regimented in what he did. Whereas my mum was always entrepreneurial. Over the years, she's run or attempted various different things, from selling a peanuts business, where us as kids would often be running in to deliver stuff, to, you know, horse box hire and things like this. It's just interesting that you've had a similar kind of grounding with parents, and then perhaps taking a little bit of both, and the fact that you're prepared to take risks and, you know, make changes so often, it's just a quick insight to that. So look, how are things now going at Catalyst? It sounds like you had kind of bit of a roller coaster start there with, you know, having to manage all that. But how are things now looking since, you know, how have they changed since day one?
You know, it is such a great business, and a great business from the perspective of the fabulous people I have on my team and the people that I get to work with every day. And a great business because what we're bringing to the market is something that the market really wants and needs. So the best way that I can demonstrate that is last year we turned away as much business as we won.
Wow.
The reason that we did that, and this is another one of the reasons I love this company, we did it because we never want to overcommit to our clients. So we will not take on work if we don't feel like we can give 110% and deliver on it. But we also don't ever want to put our staff in a position where they can't have balance in their life. So we turn away work when we don't have enough staff to be able to deliver.
That is honestly so, so important. It's one of my rules in life and in business. It's just one of those rules that is so hard to stick to at times because, you know, you can go chasing after the big bucks, etc. But I think if you folks are doing that, that is perhaps where you're going to attract good people, because as a recruiter, I speak to probably 9 out of 10 people I speak to are looking to change because they are so close to burnout that they just do not want to work where they want to work. And typically CROs don't always get the best rep because they like to get the most out of their teams and really work them into the ground because they've taken on more studies, and that comes from the top down, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It does. And I will tell you, I was listening to earnings calls a month or so ago, and the CEO of one of the largest CROs said on the earnings call, when asked about if they were turning away work because the war for talent is so tough right now, like everybody, you know, everybody's experiencing turnover, everybody's having a hard time hiring people, there just isn't enough talent out in the market. And his response was, "We never turn away work."
Wow.
So the message, and, you know, I know enough people that work there, I know how hard they're working and how close they are to burnout, but the message that they're hearing from their CEO is, we're just going to keep working you to death.
It's crazy. I've spoken to people that are working like 6 days a week from like 6 a.m. through till like 10 a.m. Now, I've done that quite often at times, but it's my business. You know, I choose to do it. It's not because I'm getting work forced on me. So it's, yeah, just, it's nuts to hear that sort of thing. Adam, what, you were going to add something here.
Yeah. So it sounds like what you're describing, Melissa, is quality over quantity, but also I think more importantly, the message that sends out to not just to your staff, but to the market is actually that you will deliver on quality and you won't overpromise and underdeliver, which is what we often see in the CRO world. And I think also it builds for a sustainable workforce. As you say, there is an enormous talent drain at the moment. People are moving around a lot and, you know, they're all chasing the buck and inflation is rising across the globe. So people are very conscious of where their money is coming from, but also where it's going to. And it's really interesting how you describe that, because there aren't many CROs that I think I've come across that take that principle. And how does that balance out between, you know, your balance sheet, namely what your goals are for the year versus what you actually deliver? Do you ever come to the end? Have you come to the end of a year and said, well, we shouldn't have turned that away? Or is there a different dynamic that's happening around that boardroom?
Not yet. We haven't had a miss yet. We've always met our goals, which is massive, right? We're thrilled about that. And we're on track to meet our goals again this year. We've taken a pause on bidding because we won a lot of work early in the year, which put a lot of pressure on our ops teams. So we've taken a pause to give them an opportunity to get people onboarded, get them trained before we have to put them in front of a client or start them on project work. And we're in a good place to be able to do that because we won a lot of business early in the year, but we check in on it every month at CP at our management meeting, but we check in on it weekly. So anytime we get information that maybe a study is going to pause, maybe that they've had bad safety signals and they might have to stop the study, we are checking in on that continuously so that we know when to turn the funnel back on. I will say, I want to be careful that I'm not painting too rosy of a picture. We all work very, very hard at Catalyst. And many of us work more than 40 hours a week, but that's partially by choice. It's exactly what you're saying. You know, we want to work hard because we're working hard to deliver and because we believe in this company and what it stands for and what we're delivering to our clients. But we also track utilization monthly, and not for the reason most companies track utilization. We track utilization to make sure that we're not overburdening our employees versus making sure that we're using every single hour that we can to make money. Hmm. We want to make sure that we're not seeing a lot of over hours on a continuous basis. Knowing that sometimes one team is going to have a month that's really, really busy. And then, maybe we need to hire some more people there to balance it out. And sometimes we're going to see months that are a little lighter for some teams, and that's okay.
I think you're spot on there, Melissa. And I guess going back to those words from the CEO who was just like, we'll never turn away business and there's a talent shortage. I don't necessarily think that there is a talent shortage. It's just where the talent is going, you know. Mm-hmm. Of course, if people are going to be expected, some of the people that I've been speaking to working 70, 80 hours a week consistently for months on end, mm-hmm. of course, there's going to be a talent shortage wherever they're working because nobody mm-hmm. really wants to do that. We've all got, families, friends, outside interests. So look, what sort of feedback are you getting from your team? And I guess, how does that then make you feel, having kind of set the strategy and the management team, putting these systems in place? What sort of feedback are you getting, and how does that then make you folks feel, I guess?
I think across the board, we're all really, really positive. We all feel very good about where we are as a company, the things that we're working to do. We're also acknowledging that we've kind of reached an inflection point. Like you said, for a 400 person company, 400 people full time, that's not small anymore. And while we have good processes in place, they don't necessarily fit where we are today. So we're actually going through a project right now where we're taking a look at all of our processes and kind of how we do things day to day to re-level set on, do we have the things in place that we need to be successful for the next 5 years? Like, we got the first 3 years down pat, and or three plus years at this point. We got that down pat. Awesome. Now we're growing. We're getting bigger. We've acquired some companies. We're in the process of integrating a company we just acquired, and we need to take that next step.
Sure. Now, I saw some news on that, and I loved one of the announcements about the recent acquisition that was publicly announced. Well, I saw it on LinkedIn. It was a Star Wars snippet announcing, the acquisition of Aptus Clinical over here in the UK. So that, piqued my interest. Would you say that that's perhaps been one of the biggest achievements, with your direct involvement today, that must have been a headache. Anything like that is never simple. And perhaps your willingness to do things the hard way was perhaps quite useful at that point, right?
Yeah, and I love the approach that we take, and we're not done acquiring companies. We'll continue to acquire companies as we continue to grow. And so the specific approach that we take is we really look for that culture match. That's almost the highest priority when we're talking to other companies that we might want to come together with, is ensuring that there's alignment between our values that we hold dear and how we interact on a day-to-day basis with each other and with our clients, and how a company that we might want to acquire does that.
Yeah.
We really start from that place. And that, I think, makes it much easier to come together. When your values are aligned, it's like a good marriage, right? You have a good marriage when your personal values are aligned. That's what we're looking for, is to build those good marriages. And then also ensuring that it's a, as we are coming into the integration phase, that it's not a top-down integration. It's a, we want to get to know you, you need to get to know us, and then we're going to take the best from each company. Because that's when you really get buy-in. Not everybody in an acquired company wants to be acquired, right? And there's lots of kind of spin and noise around any acquisition, no matter how carefully you message it, no matter how hard you work to make sure everybody's informed and aligned. But when you, and I've said this multiple times in meetings with my Aptus colleagues, when you're talking about, well, what are we going to do about X? What are we going to do about Y? My response is always, I am not making that decision. We are going to make that decision together. So let's talk about it. And I think that's how you do M&A successfully.
Melissa, as you were saying that, I know Aptus well. I know Steve McConchy. I've come across him many times. And as you were describing a marriage, it's really interesting that you describe cultural fit as much as anything else, because he's such a nice guy, he's such a good guy, and he has such an incredible track record in this industry. And it's such a small world that, you know, there is that alignment around that. But do I assume, therefore, that Aptus will be fulfilling that biometrics, data, stats, and medical writing piece? Is that the plan and where they sit?
Well, they have a little bit of everything. So they have some they're very much like a smaller version of Catalyst. They've got resourcing business that they do. They've got some full service oncology work that they do. And then they've got a consulting, which we did not do. They've got that early phase consulting work that they do. So it was really a nice kind of matchup. You know, we're similar in some areas, and then they had something that they offered that we don't offer. So that was, that's what made them a great fit for us. And we were looking to expand our infrastructure in the European Union broadly, in the UK also. And, you know, this was a great opportunity for us to partner up with a company that has infrastructure in place that we could lean into instead of having to build everything ourselves from scratch.
And as you say, from a UK Europe perspective, they have a tremendous track record, a great reputation.
Yeah.
Great people. I've come across them a number of times in my career, and I've also been to their site in Audley Edge, which is very impressive. You know, as I say, it's a very small world that we work in.
Yes, it is a very small world we work in, for sure. I'm actually going over in August. I'm looking forward to getting over there and seeing everybody actually in the office there. I got to spend some time with Steve and Jonathan here in the US. So it's been a lot of fun.
Amazing. Well, it sounds like there's been, you know, quite a bit of a journey for yourself, even, you know, throughout your short-ish time with Catalyst. You know, is there, you know, if you could place your finger on it, is there one thing that you've perhaps learned about yourself during this journey? Because from United Health to Catalyst, it's kind of like chalk and cheese. So how you've perhaps approached work has probably changed. So, yeah, what would you say you've learned about yourself during this period, Melissa?
I think one of the biggest things that I've learned is to trust myself more, because, like, you know, one of the advantages of coming to Catalyst was I had a lot more autonomy. I had a lot more ability to drive and influence change. And it's different when you've got all of that autonomy yourself.
Yeah.
Versus at United, where no matter what I did, I had to check with 50 people. Suddenly being able to take a step back and say, okay, I do have good ideas. I do know what I'm talking about. It's okay to kind of put myself out on a limb and check in with my peers and have them kind of poke holes at what I'm doing. Like, getting that level of comfort of I can do this, and I've got the right people around me to make sure I don't screw anything up too badly.
It sounds like you must have the right people around you. I mean, if people are willing to poke holes at what you're doing, that's kind of what you want, because something, you know, no one wants to be a manager or a leader where the team don't want to say anything, otherwise it's just the me show, and that's not a business, that's not a fit, that's not the culture that anyone wants to work in. So no, that sounds amazing that you've managed to achieve that in, you know, this short period of time, really.
Yeah, it, like I said, it's great fun every day. It is just so much fun to be able to work with these people and to have them challenge me and to have me have the ability to challenge them, and it to be a really healthy conversation where it leads us to the place we're trying to get to.
Definitely. So look, what's next then? You're kind of, you mentioned the headcount of approximately 400 at the moment, plus contractors. You know, what's the roadmap for yourselves moving forward?
So, you know, we've like I said, we've got a pretty, I'm not going to say aggressive growth plan. We've got a healthy growth plan over the next 5 years. We don't ever want to grow so fast, like I said before, that we're not able to deliver on our commitments to our clients and to our employees. So we've got a healthy growth plan laid out. We want to continue to expand geographically. So that's some of what I'm working on. We want to continue to build that presence in Europe. We want to look at how we effectively deliver clinical support in Asia. We want to continue to grow our flex business, which means maybe some additional growth around our biometrics functional services that we offer, our FSP services that we offer. But, you know, primarily it's about sticking to our knitting. We really have seen tremendous demand, particularly in the oncology space. We've made such great traction there and continue to, there's more demand out there than we could ever respond to. And we see that and we acknowledge that, and we don't need to go any broader than that right now. We just need to continue to do what we do really, really well. And that's going to support the growth that we've outlined for ourselves. So we continue. Yeah, we continue to hire. We've always got positions posted and working to hire ahead of the curve so that, like I said, so that our people are able to have some work-life balance and just looking towards the future and continuing to grow the company up to a point.
Wow. Well, it all sounds like very exciting times for the Catalyst team. So I know that I'll be sort of staying tuned for what's next. But Melissa, it's been great having you on to this point. But before we let you jump off to enjoy your the rest of the day over stateside, we always like to finish off the show with a quick fire questions round to kind of get to know you and your values a little bit more, in addition to what we've already run through. So look, I'll kick us off here with the first question, which is, what is the one piece of advice that you'd give to your younger self?
So it's the same advice I give to young women that I provide some career coaching to. Get outside your box, get uncomfortable. The best jobs that you're ever going to have are the ones that you wake up in the middle of the night, the day before you start the job, and you're terrified that you can't actually do it. Don't let that fear stop you.
I like that. I like that a lot.
It's a great answer, Melissa. And often when people talk about that, they talk about getting out the comfy chair. That's my comfy chair. I don't sit in it. It's just there for show.
It's a very nice chair, Adam, I have to say.
Thank you. but it speaks to that point, isn't it? It's getting out the comfy chair, getting out your comfort zone, really, really challenging yourself and pushing yourself beyond your norm and your comfort.
Yeah.
A great answer, thank you. What is the number one book or resource that you would recommend to our audience, to our listeners?
Sure. So I can't really give them a book to read because I pretty much read trash. That's how I decompress. So I love a good scary novel or a good murder mystery. But there is a podcast that I love, and I listen to a lot of podcasts also. But my favorite is Bronwyn, and I'm going to butcher her last name and she'll forgive me, I'm sure, Saglimbini's 20 Minutes with Bronwyn. And Bronwyn is a communications genius, absolutely a genius. And she has taken this podcast, which really started around how to effectively communicate, particularly in a business setting or in front of an audience, and has turned it into just so much more. And most of the podcasts are around 20 minutes until she gets into some really hot topics. And then those may go a little longer, but she's so much fun. She's been doing this for years and she knows her stuff so well. The only warning I'll give you about her podcast is sometimes they're a little not safe for work. She does have a bit of a sailor's mouth, which works well with me because I do too.
We all kind of like that, you know. We can pitch the corporate persona at times for that, and I like that kind of platform and kind of duration as well. It's like a TED talk, you know, which tend to be 18 minutes. You can get so many much out of those things. So I will definitely be checking that one out, Melissa. On to the next question. It sounds like there's been a lot of growth and there's going to be plenty more. But what are the top three qualities that you personally value most when looking to build a team?
The number one is diversity, and really diversity of thought. You cannot build a team with a bunch of people that look and think exactly like you do and expect them to do anything innovative. There's not going to be anybody there to challenge you if you do that. So that for me is the number one key to success, is making sure you have a highly diverse team. The other thing is to find people that are willing to both give and receive feedback. Feedback's a gift. We should be seeking it, and we should be giving it to people in the moment to ensure that we're all checking with each other to make sure we're effective. And without doing that check-in, you just keep doing what you've been doing and assume it's effective.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one is real passion for the work. Like, I want to find people that, and bring people onto my team that are as passionate about the work that we're doing as I am, and also that are willing to have fun and laugh. That I think is really what makes the workplace worth it, is when you build a team that works really, really hard together, but then can just absolutely die laughing together about some of the dumbest stuff.
I love that. Absolutely love that.
some brilliant answers. Honestly, some brilliant answers, Melissa, that I think give an insight into the person, into you as an individual as well. What would you say your favorite thing outside of work is? It sounds like you do spend quite a bit of time working, but I'm sure you seek downtime elsewhere.
Absolutely. Hiking with my husband and some of our dogs. Some of them are too old to hike now, and some of them are too lazy to hike, but we do have one or two that will do it with us. That's big for us, and one of the reasons we actually relocated to the mountains of North Carolina was to have more opportunities to hike, and then traveling, and cannot wait to actually get back to real deal traveling for fun again.
I like it. Any particular destination? Sorry to add a bolt on there. Any particular, what's top of the list, Melissa?
The top of the list for us next is probably Portugal. We had a trip planned for Portugal that was supposed to happen in April of 2020. So clearly that did not happen. And we've been trying to figure out a time we can get it rebooked.
Amazing. Great for golf if your husband plays.
Yes, we both play.
There you go. I've got some friends that kite surf off the northern coast of Portugal. They love it there as well.
Oh, very nice.
Cool. And look, to wrap us up, Melissa, finally, what is your number one goal for both life and business, if you were to roll that all into one, if possible?
Oh, I can. I have no tolerance for people who leave dead bodies behind them everywhere they go. I want to be kind. I want to assume positive intent. And I want to help make those people around me successful in both my personal life and my business life. And that means that somebody that's just toxic doesn't really have a place on my team or in my circle of friends.
I like it. So kind of responsibility, just taking ownership for your own shit, basically.
Yes, that's a very good way to put it. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, look, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. And look, for anyone that is looking to reach out to you or learn more about Catalyst, look, what's the best place for our audience and network to get hold of you?
Yeah, LinkedIn is always a great way to connect with me. And then I'm happy to provide my phone number and my work email address, which are also available on my LinkedIn profile.
Fantastic stuff. Well, look, thanks once again for being a guest on the Huxley Morton podcast. We'll continue to watch your journey at Catalyst. But for now, you have an amazing day.
Oh, thank you guys for inviting me. It was a real joy.
Thanks, Melissa.